Support for Switched on Pop comes from Stereophonic, Broadway's must-experience new play. If you only see one thing on Broadway this year, make sure it's Stereophonic, written by David Adjmi, directed by Daniel Auchin, and featuring original music by Arcade Fire's Will Butler. The play follows a 1970s rock band on the verge of breaking down, breaking up, or breaking through. The New York Times, The New Yorker, and New York Magazine call it best of the year, and Peter Marks of The Washington Post says, okay, I'll go there. Stereophonic is the best play of the year. Get your tickets at stereophonicplay.com/fox. Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply. Welcome to Switched on Pop. I'm songwriter Charlie Harding.
And I'm musicologist Nate Sloan.
And I am really happy to be joined by Ross Golan, who is a hit songwriter who's written with folks like Maroon 5, Justin Bieber, Selena Gomez, Ariana Grande. Woo. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Wow.
Thank you.
I also feel like we should plug, you've got a great podcast called And the Writer Is, where every week you sit down with an acclaimed and venerable songwriter to intimately discuss what happens behind closed doors in the music industry.
That's right.
Yeah. So we're so excited to have you in the room with us because, first of all, you just have incredible experience with so many songwriters. And if you look at a lot of the songs that we've covered on the show, either you or someone you've interviewed on your show has probably contributed to that song. So you've got a lot of insight into what's going on behind the process. And we reached out with a list of different songs that we wanted to potentially discuss. And one of the songs that you pointed out was Ed Sheeran's Shape of You. It's been one of the most requested songs that our listeners have asked for, and we've actually been really hesitant to look at it for a certain reason. So what I wanted to do was to break down Shape of You, and in the second half, spend time talking about your podcast, And the Writer Is.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Right on.
It might be ridiculous, but background on Ed Sheeran. So Nate and I actually have kind of intentionally ignored Ed Sheeran, and I had to look up Ed Sheeran and figure out what is going on with him.
Interesting. Why?
Nate, what do you think?
I think the probably simplest way to say it is that we haven't really been very excited by a lot of the music we've heard from him.
Ah, interesting.
So whenever we've gone to do a podcast, he's never been at the top of our list because we just didn't have that sort of visceral excitement.
He's a really interesting person. I've only met him a few times, but the first time I met him was backstage at a concert in New York, and I had just gotten off of a plane, and it was probably, I don't know, midnight. And I'm there with, I fly in with a guy named Omar Malik, who you'll see his songwriting credits all over the place. And we were meeting up backstage at, I can't even remember whose show it was, but we were meeting up with Benny Blanco, who has just recently executive produced this Ed Sheeran record. And backstage was J. Cole and Skrillex. And we're all in a circle drinking whiskey and doing shots of Jameson. And Ed Sheeran starts freestyling. The minute Ed starts freestyling is the minute you realize who Ed really is.
Yeah.
And as an artist, I've worked with a ton of people. I don't know that many people who spit out that volume of interesting lyrics so quickly. I mean, he's truly a savant. And the more you get into it and the more you actually go and experience him live or you experience him in person, that's when you actually understand Ed Sheeran.
First of all, I'll say, wow, what an image of all those songwriters and musicians
I'm the lowest on the rung in that room. You know, it's just like jaw-dropping talent.
They needed you to make a mignon, so that's why you were there.
Exactly.
I hear what you're saying. In a way, I feel like I like everything about Ed Sheeran. I like his live shows are simply jaw-dropping. I haven't been there in person, but I've watched them online. In interviews, he's like effortlessly charming and hysterically funny. and he seems really smart. I feel like I like everything about him except his music. So I'm actually glad to have this opportunity to go deeper into that terrain with both of you and see you know, how we feel on the other end.
Yeah, I think part of what we're looking for is to help convert, not so much as convert skeptics, but to say that I think on first listen, I often just haven't paid attention. Like the first listen, I'm like, oh, didn't catch me. I'll go find another song for this week. And I actually did finally go up and look at sort of just Ed Sheeran's Wikipedia page. I was like, wait a minute. Okay, I know he's a major pop star, but the list of things about his background is insane. From being discovered by Jamie Foxx in a small LA club, to writing for Taylor Swift, touring with her, winning multiple Grammys, getting huge support by Elton John. And I think I read that for his not the most recent album, but the album before, he wrote 140 songs in order to pare it down to...
That sounds right.
Well, yeah. So I honestly just sort of looking at that and then looking at some of his credits. He's written for Justin Bieber. The song we're going to talk about was originally supposedly written for Rihanna. He's now acting on Game of Thrones. Like, the size of his stardom kind of really... I was almost starstruck just reading the Wikipedia. And I thought, you know, one of the things that maybe we're guilty of is being too stuck in our taste. And so what I wanted to do was take a second to listen to just a little bit of Shape of You together and then break down what's going on.
Let's do it.
Right on.
The club isn't the best place to find a lover, so the bar is where I go. Me and my friends at the table doing shots, tripping fast, and then we talk slow. Come over and start up a conversation with just me, and trust me, I'll give it a chance. Now take my hand, stop it, and the man on the jukebox, and then we start to dance. And now I'm singing like, girl, you know I want your love. Your love was handmade for somebody like me. Come on now, follow my lead. I may be crazy, don't mind me. Say, boy, let's not talk too much. Grab on my waist and put that body on me. Come on now, follow my lead. Come, come on now, follow my lead.
So one of my favorite books in the world is this book by Carl Wilson called Let's Talk About Love. You read this one?
No.
It's a critique of Celine Dion's 1999 album, Let's Talk About Love. The conceit of the book is basically that it's not about Celine Dion. It's actually about taste. And he argues that so often critics use taste as a way to reinforce class structures around what is good and what is not good. And he basically says that there's a major chasm between the perspective of critics on Celine Dion's music and her mass appeal. So I think in some ways, Nate and I might be guilty of, as I was saying, sort of falling into traps of our own taste and upon first listen, just being like, that song's not for me. So what I want to do together is break down what is working about this song. So I just want to hear from your perspective. What captures you when you listen to this tune?
Well, this is fascinating for a couple reasons. One is Benny, the guy who executive produced the album, was our first guest on And
right.
The Writer Is.
It's a great interview.
And we were talking about this song and the release of this song.
Yeah.
And Ed knew through the process, he's involved. Right now, he's planning out the next album. Like, while we're analyzing this,
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the first four albums he essentially had planned.
Oh, my gosh.
You know? So here we are working on this new album. And to him, he's the one who said, let's go and release two singles on the same day. Releases this and Castle on the Hill.
Right.
He says this and the label's like, no. And he says, just trust me. He's the one who has his finger on the pulse of what's actually working. It's sort of what you were talking about, where Celine's releasing songs and choosing to release songs because she knows her fan base loves it. She's not really concerned about what the critics think.
Right.
She's releasing gold and platinum records because that's the process.
Right.
This song in particular, he wrote with Steve Mack along with two other songs that day. And when they did it, they thought this was going to be, they actually thought this was going to be maybe a Little Mix song. Like, Steve loved it. And afterwards, they went back and they said, well, what do you think of this? And Ed was like, I don't know. Maybe it's more of that.
Right. Because it has a different sort of feel than Ed Sheeran is known for. It's not so much the acoustic guitar feel. It's sort of a dance number.
Right. But the thing is that what Steve's great at as the producer of this song, and what he's great at in general, is that he knows how to, the track's minimal.
Yeah.
So there's not there's not so much going on that you can't just hear the song, and the voice is what really matters.
Yep.
The club isn't the best place to find the lovers, so the bar is where I go.
And he worked on the track and made sure the track was as good as it could be.
Mm.
It was, I actually think maybe some of the other songs that they did that day may have also been cut by other artists.
Mm.
But this one they knew was a special song. They just didn't know necessarily where it would go. And you'll see with writers throughout the process of an album, they'll choose their single partly around, you know, if everybody wants to cut this song,
yeah,
then at some point they may just say, I guess I should release it. So, you know, I think that, you know, this song in particular, what I like about it is that it's super patient.
It's really patient.
You know, to wait after the one on that pre-chorus is what makes that pre-chorus work. Because of the one, that break, it allows us to get sucked in for a second.
Right.
Which is the only reason why, you know, the chorus really pops the way it does, is because of the patience going into that pre-chorus.
I'm in love with the shape of you. We push and pull like a magnet do.
And then supporting that lyrical or the rhythmic patience, there is just a really slow build, right? We have a single riff throughout the entire song.
That's right.
This sort of kalimba feel.
Which is really hard. It's hard to write a song where each section has dynamics and they're unique, while the track doesn't really slap you in the face with, here's the chorus.
Yep.
You know, it's a lot of voice. And his voice sounds amazing on this record.
This is where, upon listening multiple times, I realized that this isn't a departure for Ed Sheeran, but it's actually very much his kind of song.
Yep.
So I think people are deceived by the sample that runs throughout, right? That looping,
right,
funky sound, this thing, right?
Yeah.
So when you hear this, you're like, oh, this could be a Diplo track, right?
Sure.
But then what you get immediately after are acoustic guitar drumming. And Ed Sheeran is known for his live show where he loops himself over and over and over again. And in many ways, this song builds almost like a solo song that he's looping on his guitar. And each element comes in slowly and then drops back out as if he's hitting a looping pedal.
Yeah, you can see it best in the Grammys this year.
Yeah.
He was there and he did it live, and you can see what he's capable of there.
Oh, yes, it's remarkable. Yeah. And then even just the flow of his words is very normal for Ed Sheeran. You have a lot of lyrics happening really quickly with a lot of syncopated rhythm, and it works really well with this track, but it's something that he does just as well with a strumming acoustic guitar. So I think he's actually really taking his style as of a live performer, his style as a lyricist, his style as an acoustic guitar player, and he's just giving you something slightly different, this little loop. And for most listeners, they think, oh, this is a total departure, but it's actually very much in line with everything that he does.
Yeah, and in a way, shame on the artist who just releases the same song over and over again.
Yeah, right.
You know, the guy who releases, if he comes out and he releases A-Team again, my guess is we're all going to say, ah, he already did this and he didn't do it as well as A-Team.
Right.
I applaud an artist, especially of the magnitude of Ed's career right now.
Yeah.
Not only does he release it, but the idea was that when he releases, he's going to release Castle on the Hill at the exact same time.
Which is a totally different song.
Totally different song. And it allows his fan base to say he didn't leave us completely. So he's really smart in making sure that other song will keep the wolves at bay.
Right. While Shape of You might climb up the top 40 and bring in new listeners that might otherwise not have paid attention, a la me and Nate.
I've heard that this song was not even going to make the album.
Really?
Yeah. There are some songs that are on the cusp of, well, it doesn't make sense in the album, but it's right. such a good song that maybe it should be the single. And that happens on a regular basis because you have a collection of the core 8-9 songs that make up the album. And then you're trying to figure out what are the best songs that have the best shot. And he decides to go with Shape of You. And I know there were some opponents to that song being the single. And it's that thing of, and he knows this, that if it works and radio does respond to it, then it's fair game for whatever he decides the second, third, fourth, fifth single is.
Oh, interesting.
Because he then depicts, he's the one who's dictating the how radio programmers are choosing the next single. And if they fall for Shape of You, they're going to fall for the rest of the album. And it worked. It was a, it's a brilliant strategy.
Wow.
And it's a lot of strategy on that side.
That's, you know, I'm thinking about what you've said, and maybe now can credit Ed Sheeran a little more with being having a very productive mix of being like at once very calculating and at the same time kind of spontaneous. Like these anecdotes, you know, of like having the control over his release strategy and that kind of calculation, at the same time the spontaneity of busting out a freestyle. Maybe we hear both of those in his music. Like I'm thinking about this song now in terms of the what Charlie was talking about, the way it's just like filled with lyrics that sound at once very conversational and very natural. And at the same time you think, no, he really carefully selected where each of these words go, and as you were pointing out, like where they go in terms of the rhythm of the song, giving a pause on the first, on the downbeat. So maybe I'm starting to see, like, maybe that's kind of a part of the secret of his success, is that it's like sound, it's very calculated, but sounds very casual at the same time.
Last thing I'll say before we get into the song, because I know we need to do that, but you know, his ingenuity in something like Love Yourself, which is conversational and is so colorful, his ability to write that record, and that's an Ed Sheeran record. It was the fact that it was mean that he didn't want to release it. The fact that it was not, I mean, otherwise that'd be an Ed Sheeran record.
If you like the way you look that much, oh baby, you should go and love yourself.
So he's still making sure that he puts out records that are primarily a positive message, or they're a colorful message.
Well, that gets us into maybe the song. The opening lyric is, "The club isn't the best place to find a lover, so the bar is where I go."
The club isn't the best place to find a lover, so the bar is where I go.
I think it's a really great line because first it references the tone of the song, right? This is a club song. But it's also subverting its own expectations.
Right?
And the idea of, man, I'm not having a good time dancing on the floor, I'm just going to go hang out with my friends at the bar and have a drink, is immediately recognizable, right? Like anybody can grab onto that, like, oh yeah, I know how that feels. And so it has that conversational feeling. And it's actually why upon further listening to this track, I was grabbed by it.
It's smart. I mean, you'll start realizing as we go through all these lyrics that none of them are by accident.
Right.
It's the little details. It's when you say, you know, your love was handmade for somebody like me.
Girl, you know I want your love. Your love was handmade for somebody like me.
The word handmade for somebody like me is actually way more descriptive than we would probably give it credit for just listening in pass. You know, like you would just listen to it and you'd say, like, whatever you would say. I guess there are a million ways you could say that in it. I don't know if I've ever heard that in a song. I don't know if I've actually ever heard your love was
handcrafted.
You know, your
like
love
a,
was handmade for somebody like me. I don't know if I've ever heard those words before in a pre-chorus. And when you think about it, how many of those moments does it take to make a song unique? And already he's starting off with this strong line, and that song's in the pre-chorus, you know?
Yeah, that handmade line really stood out for me the first time I heard it, and kind of is like in some ways the linchpin of this whole song, because I think if we get into a little bit why we also take issue with Ed Sheeran, part of it would be a certain, what we perceive as a certain genericness in some of his songs. But that line cuts through in such a powerful way, because you're right, it is unique and a little familiar, but also unexpected. So yeah, so I think I like that you highlighted that line. That seems like an important one.
Yeah, it's even in the rhyme scheme in the chorus.
Mm-hmm. I'm in love with the shape of you. We push and pull like a magnet do. Although my heart is falling too, I'm in love with your body. And last night you were in my room, and now my bedsheets smell like you. Every day discovering something brand new.
For him to essentially not make it rhyme with I'm in love with your body and have it tied into every day discovering something brand new, I always thought he was going to go and rhyme with body.
Mm. Right.
You know, but instead he goes, I'm in love with the shape of you, which is actually more of like a Nashville style rhyme scheme.
Oh, yeah.
Which is really interesting. To me, that was a really interesting choice that may have happened in the moment. I'm not saying that was necessarily deliberate. But that's a really smart rhyme scheme because you're expecting it to rhyme with body. At least I was.
Yeah.
But it, because it rhymes, it's not wrong. It's just a choice. So I like that. And again, remember, when you're listening to A-Team, let's go back to the beginning, because I think if you judge Ed Sheeran on this and his uh-huh. whole career on this, or even, you know, what's the record that he won Song of the Year for?
Thinking Out Loud?
Yeah, Thinking Out Loud.
Thinking Out Loud.
Like, yeah. That's like a stream of consciousness. Not only is it... You know, it's everything that's antithetical to my career as a professional songwriter, you know. But then you go and you hear what he can do on something like Love Yourself, and you realize that sometimes he's intentionally speaking off the cuff. And the reason why his fan base loves him so much is that it sounds like that kid who is the best guitarist, singer, songwriter in your dorm. And you don't feel like, like this guy is... He's not a product. He doesn't look like the product. He doesn't right. sound like the product. And he deliberately releases songs along the way that can keep you guessing whether or not he's the guy in the dorm or he's Taylor Swift.
Right.
And that's like, and Taylor Swift is also good at that.
Yeah.
But those are super deliberate writers who are doing that on purpose.
It's a clever double act to be able to sustain like that. I agree.
I like how you say he keeps us guessing, and perhaps that's what makes this song particularly powerful. We've established that it runs on a loop of the exact same chord progression throughout. You have underlying throughout most of the song, the kalimba sound and the acoustic guitar drumming. They drop in and out a little bit here and there.
Kalimba, incidentally, the sound of 2016, as we were told by Gray in our last episode.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's already, this is the pinnacle of it, you know, and if right. you're talking about 10 years ago, people are using shorty in every song, you know, or right. you start using the word swag in a song, or you have dubstep bridges. Everything had a dubstep bridge, right. whatever that right. is, you know,
right.
this is the same sound that you hear in, you yep. know, Don't Wanna Know.
I don't wanna know, no, 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 who's taking you home, oh, 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 I'm loving you so, 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 so.
It's basically the manifestation of what Kygo did last year.
Yep.
And this is the pinnacle of where it enters the pop zeitgeist. It's also the thing that a lot of labels are already like, we already have it.
Well, so if it is so established, I think this is exactly the point. It's what he does with it and makes it different, and where he subverts her expectations that makes it work.
Well, because it doesn't work with Ed Sheeran. Like, who would have thought it sounds, you know, it's like a remix of an Ed Sheeran record.
Yeah.
If Ed Sheeran is successfully both establishing something where our expectations are set and then subverts them, where in this song, musically, do you feel like he's playing with our expectations really successfully?
Well, I mean, you've realized, obviously, you guys are on the same page with this, that, you know, being a writer isn't being an illusionist. So the fact, it's what I was saying right from the beginning, that you kind of have this wordy verse.
The club isn't the best place to find the lovers, so the bar is where I go.
Sort of rap-ish. Mm. You know, it's reminiscent of kind of that early 2000s, kind of like, well, you dance to in your fraternity or something like that. It's like kind of like it's got like a Biggie Light kind of vibe.
I never thought it could happen, this rapping stuff. I was too used to packing gats and stuff. Now honeys play me close like butter play toast. From the Mississippi down to the East Coast.
And then I think that pre-chorus, the fact that it comes in late, that's sort of going from the verse and you have this wordiness and then purposefully giving that space before the first line of the pre-chorus is really the example of writing at your best.
Mm-hmm. I'm in love with the shape of you. We push and pull like a magnet do. Although my heart is falling too. I'm in love with your body. And last night you were in my room. And now my bedsheets smell like you. Every day discovering something brand new.
Just when you're waiting for that song, I mean, that's a lot of dead space.
Yeah,
it's a lot of dead space in the middle of a pop record. To have, what is that? I mean, I guess the line before it ends before the one that comes in on what, beat three? So you're talking about a whole measure of just kind of like nothing.
Yeah, no three long beats.
Well, actually, then you have the
yep, you have a little lead in.
That was super smart. It gives. I always talk about how we have to frame things. We have to frame titles. We have to frame sections. And he so well frames each section in this. You know what the verse is, what the pre-chorus is, and what the chorus is. And you are dragged through it whether you like it or not.
Right.
Even the fact that you guys aren't into it, you still at the end, it doesn't matter whether you like it or not. You still ended up listening to the whole thing because it's super well crafted.
Again, I think part of the reason why I jumped into this thinking, it's not for me, is I think when I first heard that first loop, I was like, I'm not interested. But then I listened all the way through. And then I went and recreated the entire track and tried to break down every little piece. There's so many pieces which are so intentionally assembled to get you from one section into another or to make you hear a section in a new way. All of these moments where there is spaciousness in his vocals, part of what's happening is there's also these wild polyrhythms happening with a triplet feel in that main line, which is then being supported by or augmented by synth strings that pop up and are kind of in the background and give you something to just like pop up on that last beat of the triplet. So in the kalimba, they go da, da, da. That last note, he'll add a little da, da, strings that pop up over it. And so it's just constantly, each time that it comes through, it's in a new context, even though it's fundamentally so simple.
Yeah.
And each time that he goes into a new section, we get, whether it's he adds an analog bass, he adds sort of a bigger, thicker bass, he adds those synth strings, there's subtle clapping with lots of reverb. And each time, it feels like you're listening to the same thing, but it has a totally new context. So I think those rhythms and how they support each other really reinforces that idea that he can leave spaciousness in his vocals because there's something which is going to catch you and you're going to dance to.
Yeah.
Yes, it does seem like the further we dig into this song, the more there is to laud here. But gentlemen, at this point, I have to say it is time to take our commercial break. So when we return, more with Ross Golan. Stay tuned.
Support for Switched on Pop comes from Stereophonic, Broadway's must experience new play. If you're anything like us, you're obsessed with music. Not just listening to it, but everything behind the scenes as well. What makes a good band? What makes a great song? And what does it take to make it big? All of these questions and more are explored in the remarkable new Broadway play, Stereophonic. The New York Times, The New Yorker, and New York Magazine call it best of the year, and Peter Marks of The Washington Post says, okay, I'll go there. Stereophonic is the best play of the year. Written by David Adjmi, directed by Daniel Auchin, and featuring original music by Arcade Fire's Will Butler, the story follows an up-and-coming 1970s rock band as they gather in a California music studio to record a brand new album. But it's a bumpy ride that threatens to tear the band apart. You may find yourself being reminded of the famous recording processes for legendary bands like Led Zeppelin, Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, and Fleetwood Mac. So get your tickets now and see Stereophonic live on Broadway this spring. Visit stereophonicplay.com/vox for more info. Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Welcome back to Switched on Pop. We are here in the studio with songwriter extraordinaire Ross Golan. Not only does he write number one hits for artists like Ariana Grande and Selena Gomez, he also has an awesome podcast where he talks to other songwriters. It's called And the Writer Is.
Thank you.
So you have the opportunity to talk to songwriters all the time, both as a career songwriter. You are constantly collaborating. It's not the individual genius writing on sheet paper anymore, right?
But those are collaboration too.
That even ever existed is a myth.
But that was collaboration. I want people to look up the Brill Building.
Yeah.
Which pre-1964 was essentially a bunch of, you know, mostly two-person writing teams that really were shaping pop music. And they would go and they would have these cubicles essentially with a piano. People would walk in and they would say, what if you do that? What if you do that? And in that era, I have this debate a lot because I'm part of the Grammy board and we talk about these kinds of things. You know, there was an era where the guy who goes, do, 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 doesn't get songwriting credit. You know, the guy who goes, do, 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 is playing bass in a bar in Toronto right now to make a living, even though he wrote the hook on two number one songs. So when you see a list of writers, we're making up for the faults of all the generations in you know, Motown side. That's not Brill Building, those two songs, but where they weren't giving songwriting credit to the people who were actually writing some of the main themes and songs.
Right.
So we're a different generation where collaboration is essential in what we do, and we actually give credit. So rather than looking at a song like, oh, yeah, they only had needed two writers to write this song, and you see all those memes where it'll be 20 writers on a Beyonce song, and they'll show two, and they'll somehow say, like, this is better. No, 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 no. Yep. Those two guys stole a bunch of ideas by the 11 guys who are actually writing a lot of the music. And they, you know, you could look at it like that, too. And this is coming from the guy who's writing almost all the lyrics and melodies in sessions.
So you've expanded this collaboration beyond just the songwriting room. You're now taking that collaborative songwriting process into a larger conversation. You have a podcast called And the Writer Is, and it's an interview show where you talk one-on-one with other songwriters who I imagine are both part of your songwriting network, which is an ever-expanding intersecting circle of other songwriters, and you start to see one songwriter participate in this with this other person, and they're all linked together. I wanted to ask you about what kind of things come up between two writers that's different than, say, when a songwriter goes and talks to Terry Gross.
I like that you asked that question because I think that's the real difference between what we're doing and what you get on NPR. And the reality is that one is all songwriters have gone through a little bit of the same process. We all wanted to get in the music business. You know, songwriters were either trying to be artists or they want to be artists still.
Right.
So most of the guys have either been in bands, have had record deals, they've worked with bands. We have this similarity there. But in the real human sense, we spend hours and hours together. We eat meals together.
Yeah.
We eat. We all know when our families are sick.
Yeah.
When it's my wedding and half the people there are songwriters, it's not because, you know, and you're talking about we have a bunch of number one writers and Grammy-nominating, Grammy-winning producers at our weddings. It's not because we're trying to network. It's because when I'm in a session, we're really telling each other what really matters.
Yeah.
And we're there to hear all of it.
So
the darkest and the happiest. I mean, you know, talking about the guys from Shape of You, and you're like, you know, you can hear in the Benny, the executive producer, that if you listen to that, you can hear, one, we've been close for a long time, but his story's incredible. You know, you're talking about a guy who wrote "And I Kissed a Girl" at 18 years old, and and that was not, he had, before that, had already had number one songs.
Wow.
You're talking about a guy who essentially lived on the streets in New York because his mentor passes away and he's looking for a place to live. And you're like, this guy's journey is incredible.
That interview had me totally enraptured in it. His story is...
Yeah, like, how are we supposed to be friends? Like, how am I? I'm just an overgrown kid from the suburbs of Chicago who, with Steve Mack, you know, when I go to London, Steve, the producer of Shape of You, you know, I tend to write mostly with Steve when I'm there. So we go and we spend, you know, I get a hotel that's only three stops away from, you know, from his studio. And we spend a lot of time just the two of us in front of a piano. You know, and it's just the two of us talking about life. I've gone to concerts with him and his girls, you know. I know about his family. I know these guys are not just, to everybody else, they're writers, and to us, we're family. We're literally going through this grind together because we have to. It's just this huge network of friends and family, which is different than that previous generation. You know, when we talk about all those songs that had only two writers on it, man, I wish I was back then. I'd be a lot more wealthy. But in a practical sense, there was a lot of animosity in that generation. And there were a lot of bullies in the music business. And right now, there are no bullies. You have to be nice. You have to be friends because word travels really fast when you're a dick. So everyone's friends with each other. And this podcast, to me, I have this book that everybody signs that I work with.
Yeah.
And there's 400 names in it. It's everyone from like Bon Jovi to, you know, David Guetta. And then it's everyone from Lamont Dozier to Max Martin. And to me, it's like, I want to go back and I want to sit there and talk to these guys about how is it possible that I'm sitting in a room with Savin Kotecha, who wrote Into You, who I, you know, when you guys did that. Savin's this guy who was born in a conservative Indian family in the middle of conservative Texas. And he happens to write songs in his room because he loves it.
Yeah.
He writes a song and he sends off this song to like a competition. He ends up getting this weird deal with in Nashville. The song ends up making it to the A&R for Backstreet Boys, and he almost had a 100% song on Millennium until his parents said, no, you made a deal with somebody in Nashville, you can't do that. At 17 years old, he almost sold 25 million copies of a song. So how does this kid in a conservative family in Texas, he's a first generation American, how does he end up in Sweden? How does he then marry a girl, end up as a vocal coach on X Factor in the UK, where he has the opportunity to break One Direction?
Wow.
Which then brings him to LA, where he then ends up being a big part of Max Martin's publishing company.
Yeah.
How is it that guy, who I've been friends with for years, you know, I write Dangerous Woman in my car, you know, spend a month on that chorus, bring it into my friend who I write almost everything with. We rewrite the song, put it all together, and we show Savin. And even though at this time it was with another artist, Savin's like, let me play it for Ariana. He plays it for Ariana. Ariana comes upstairs and says, can I please make this the lead single? I'll make this the name of my tour and my album if you just let me have a chance.
Yeah.
So we give her the chance and she kills it. And so my life has changed because an Indian guy from Texas finds his way into the same family that I end up in. Like, that's what that podcast is about.
I like that you call it a family, because not only are your stories interconnected because you all depend upon each other, but in the songwriting process, you have to have such a deep level of trust, because you have to be able to say, your chorus doesn't work. You're going to scrap that. We're going to do this. Okay, cool. Oh, but your idea, no. Well, let's work on something together. You're constantly having to be vulnerable. You're having to give up ideas. You're having to present ideas. And you have to be in a place of both having complete buy-in around the vision of what you're producing, but also no attachment to what's happening as it's going.
Yeah. Imagine these artists who are all over TMZ, who are all over the world, and they have to walk in and they have to tell me, their deepest, darkest things that are going on. You know, like these people are really brave in many ways, and they're having to walk in and they have to go and they have to tell me about what they're really dealing with, and they have to trust me.
Yeah.
You know, I always say, if you want to know what it's like to write a song, to be a professional writer, walk in a room with people you don't know, sing at them, and then ask what they think.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I mean, that's terrifying. Have to walk in, and every single time, I mean,
yeah,
I was with a major artist last night, and it's still the same thing. It's like, okay, I have this idea. Is this any good?
Yeah.
You know, for all angles. I mean, we're all like that with each other, and it's like, I have no idea. I mean, imagine just walking into any room and seeing it at whoever the people are in the room, and just, you'd be nervous. I don't care how many times you've done it. I don't care how many times you think you've had a hit song. Like, you're just a kid in their car thinking of a concept and working through a melody and being like, I don't know. Is this good? And I guess the writer is, what's so exciting about it is that we talk a lot about process and how people write, but the people who write these songs are just fascinating.
Yeah, there's some really great stories in there.
Yeah.
So if people want to go listen, they should find it iTunes, anywhere you find your podcast.
iTunes, Spotify now. Yeah. It's basically anywhere we can find podcasts. All of our handles are at And the Writer Is, or cool. I'm at Ross Golan. And there you go.
Awesome. Well, it was such a pleasure having you on the show. Really excited to break down those songs. I definitely am a bit more of an Ed Sheeran convert, both for his sheer talent that is incredible to hear about, and also as I listen more to his tracks, I find I am more drawn in. So thanks for breaking it down with us.
Yeah, of course. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thanks, Ross. Switched On Pop is produced and edited by me, Nate Sloan, and him, Charlie Harding. Bill Lance is our incredible editor. You can find more episodes of Switched On Pop on whatever podcast listening device is your method. And you can go to our website, www.switchedonpop.com. Reach out to us on Twitter or Facebook at Switched On Pop. We love to continue the conversation. Big thanks to Luke Harris, who does all our design. And we are proud members of the Panoply Network. Stay tuned. 2 weeks from now, more deep dives into pop hits. As always, thanks for listening.
Support for Switched On Pop comes from Stereophonic, Broadway's must experience new play. If you only see one thing on Broadway this year, make sure it's Stereophonic, written by David Adjmi, directed by Daniel Auchin, and featuring original music by Arcade Fire's Will Butler. The play follows a 1970s rock band on the verge of breaking down, breaking up, or breaking through. The New York Times, The New Yorker, and New York Magazine call it best of the year, and Peter Marks of the Washington Post says, okay, I'll go there. Stereophonic is the best play of the year. Get your tickets at stereophonicplay.com/fox.